"It does not take a majority to prevail," said Samuel Adams, "but rather an irate, tireless minority, keen on setting brush fires of freedom in the minds of men. Well, I've got the matches. Are you ready to combust? I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is the Jewish Heroism Project. From Servitude to Service, a pre-Pesach conversation with Rav Yehuda HaKohen. Okay, I am sitting with my good friend and fellow educator, Rav Yehuda HaKohen. He's the educational director of the Vision Movement. He's a regular lecturer at Machon Meir. You can get there and hear his Torah. And also a tremendously creative thinker in my eyes. And I'm super excited to do a little bit of preparation for the upcoming Passover holiday with you. Shalom Yehuda, how are you doing?
Shana Tova.
Shana Tova. Now, why some people might be a little confused by the greeting, so you got to at least say a word.
It's Rosh Chodesh Nisan.
It is indeed the beginning of the month of Nisan. And why is that? That is, deserve a happy new year?
Because it's our new year.
Meaning our being who?
The people of Israel.
People of Israel. It's our, the Hebrew new year.
It's the Hebrew new year. It's the internal Israeli new year.
Yes.
As opposed to Rosh Hashanah, which is the universal new year, according to the Jews.
That's right. Meaning the Rosh Hashanah is marking the creation of the world. Mm-hmm. And Pesach marks the birth of the Jewish people.
Right.
And not just our birth, but our entry into service, so to speak. And that's exactly what I want to speak about today. Just by way of introduction, so we can dive right in, because I wouldn't presume to think that you've been listening to my content. But I've been mapping out what I call the Torah's heroic face. There's five elements to a heroic journey, which I'm quite convinced can serve on the individual, on the communal, and really on the cosmic level to help us harness the powers within ourselves and in creation to really become heroes. And in that, the second path is the path of avoda, work, right? Life is work. And anybody who tells you otherwise is simply lying and looking to get your money, right? I mean, on a simple level. But since life is work, since we can accept that, we can either serve our stomachs or we can serve something higher. Which brings me to the topic at hand, because growing up, did you ever watch the Cecil B. DeMille Ten Commandments movie? Charlton Heston as Moses, also in the background of everyone's mind as God, you know?
I think I know it by heart.
Okay, good. So we also, my brother and I, have many, many memories of like sitting in my parents' bed at night watching it on TV. So that movie's fantastic, and I think it did a lot for my sense of Jewish pride, if nothing else, in my identity. But I do feel that it planted deep in my Jewish consciousness, American Jewish consciousness, and I know from asking many of my peers the same, an incredible flawed understanding of what Torah is, and more specifically, of what Pesach is about. Because we all learned that the famous line is, "Let my people go," mm-hmm. which fit a very nice Jewish-American perspective, which is that the story of Pesach is about a liberation from slavery to freedom, which is not entirely untrue. I mean, the Haggadah does say that one of the narrative's arcs is moving from, you know, Avdut Lecherut, from slavery to... Cherut is only loosely translated as freedom, by the by. Maybe we'll come back to that. But the reality is the second half of Moses' statement is what? You know, "Let my people go that they
will serve me."
Serve me in the wilderness, right? Serve me, meaning we go from being the servants of Paro to the servants of God, or more correctly, from the slaves of Paro to the servants of God. Mm-hmm. So in general, what I would like to discuss is how does one free themselves from servitude by entering into service?
Well, first of all, I want to point out this is not a new question.
Sure.
My understanding of what was taking place at the time is that the Hebrew slaves in Egypt had an expectation for generations that they would go free and return to the land of their ancestors, but they were not expecting a Torah.
Yeah, I mean, Yosef left them the message, "There will come a redeemer, Pakod Pakadi, right? He will redeem you." He didn't mention anything. Right? So meaning they also had watched the Charlton Heston version there in slavery, and they were waiting to be free. That's a good point.
Right. And remember, Moshe is a very authoritarian personality. He's raised as royalty in the superpower of the world at that time.
Sure.
You know, he's essentially in line for the throne.
Prince of Egypt.
Yeah. And I think even this idea of Brit Sinai, of a covenant that would include a lot of rules and laws, which is important for governing society. I think Moshe could appreciate that. I think that's part of what sold him on the mission. I think that's part of how the Creator coerced Moshe into playing this role, that we're going to have a lot of rules and we're going to...
Interesting. Oh, just pause for a second. I want to make sure I understand you. Meaning, Moshe was raised and perhaps even had a personal leaning toward law and the power of law and et cetera. And when God wanted to send him on a mission, it wasn't just to redeem, but it was to bring people into a structure of law that would allow them to fulfill a purpose.
Right. And I think part of the issue is at this time, Moshe had already consciously rejected Israel. This is how Rav Manitou teaches it, that when Moshe killed the Egyptian for beating a Hebrew slave, he was actually trying to incite a slave revolt. That didn't happen. Not only did the revolt not happen, but they threatened to turn him in.
Sure.
And so this caused him to see that the Hebrews are not just slaves practically, but deeply slaves in their essence, aren't capable of a revolt. And I think what he was doing in Midian was trying to create a new Hebrew nation. Remember, Midian is the son of Abraham.
Sure.
So like trying to create a new Hebrew nation that would replace Israel. And what Hashem basically does at the burning bush is coerce Moshe back into this role of liberating the Israelites.
Wow. So at the very least, he had certainly turned his back on the Hebrews.
Well, it makes sense if we fast forward to the Golden Calf episode, and what Hashem offers him there is, we're going to wipe them out and start again with you.
Oh, in parentheses, as you wanted to in the first place.
Exactly.
Ah, yeah, fair. That's a nice connection.
Like a test to see if Moshe had truly evolved internally.
Ah, beautiful, because that's the moment in which Moshe shows his absolute devotion to the Jewish people, to the Israelites,
right,
and not just to God.
Exactly.
So, and over and above the confines of the law, you're actually offering something which I don't want to drift into now, but I'll take for thought later, a whole evolution of Moshe's personality in those elements.
Right. Meaning originally he's coerced externally to fill this role, but ultimately he comes to identify with Israel and see their role in Hashem's historic plan.
So let's start with the concept of freedom, even though I said I don't...
Well, it's a question of who are we? Meaning the question you're posing, what's the difference between servants to Paro or slaves to Paro and servants to Hashem, is what are we really on the inside? Because what freedom means for us is really determined by who are we at the core? What are we at the core? And I think this stands, for example, I'll give you a great practical example today. You know, in the machloket between, I think, Western civilization and Hebrew civilization, we have a concept of a yetzarah.
An evil inclination.
Right. We have this concept that there is something inside us that is at the same time external to who we really are, trying to coerce our behavior towards doing something that is actually a betrayal of ourselves on some level. Right.
You don't think that Western society has that? Because it sounds awfully Freudian.
No, I think Western society, for the most part, would identify what we call the Yetzirah as the true you, as the true person inside.
I think it's swung on that. You're right. I mean, you know what I mean by the Freudian. I mean, the basic tension in Freud's thought is that there's what he calls the pleasure principle, seeking to do whatever you want, your Yetzer. Right? And then there's sort of like the normative societal suppression of that in order to control, and all his neuroses flow from the conflict there. But I think what you're pointing out is that Western society has given up on the control and just says, you do you.
Right. And to be truly free from a Western perspective is to do what you want when you want.
Have no constraints on your behaviors and therefore your desires.
Right.
We see this a lot in the world today, where what would have once been considered licentiousness is now just considered license.
And whereas in Israelite culture, like if you look at Pirkei Avot, Gibor is someone who can control their Yetzirah.
Right. Biblically, a gibor is someone who controls the world around them. But in the mind of the sages, they took it one step further without erasing that. They said, that's not so impressive, actually. Mm-hmm. Control the world within you, that's the real effort.
I might be functioning with the assumption that a lot of the teachings of our sages were just a given to the biblical heroes as well.
Okay.
That's just the culture and worldview and value system of the Israelites that the sages put into writing.
I hear it, although I think it's an important evolution, especially when it comes to Gibor. Mm-hmm. This is particularly close to my heart, because the Gibor is one of the models of Jewish hero, that the Gibor in the time of David swung his spear over 300 dead, right? Because that was what the people really required in its ability to assert will in the world, which is really what the Gibor is. The sages, I think, were building on top of that. They said, yes, of course that's necessary, but it's not enough. Right. And there may have been, we could debate.
I know I put it a slightly different way. I would say that what you described as the Tanachi Gibor, the biblical hero, was practically absent from the period of the sages.
Yes.
And for the most part, not always, there were revolts against the Greeks and the Romans.
Sure, sure.
But for the most part, that model was absent. And what some might assume, I don't think you're saying this, but what some might say the sages replaced the concept with, I would argue, was there the whole time.
And it emerged into that available space.
Well, that's all that was left. It's all we were left with. But okay. Not that didn't exist in the time of David. And I think David personally struggled a lot with these questions of self-control.
There's no question about that. Okay, so back to the initial very important assertion you made, which is that if we're going to have a discussion, we need to define our terms. And in defining our terms, we come into a conflict of cultures.
Mm-hmm.
Because freedom in the Western sense is really what I would call liberation, right? Freedom from.
Okay.
As opposed to the freedom of, mm-hmm. which goes to the heart of the question you said, which is, well, freedom is related to who you actually are. Because then freedom becomes a means of expression of.
Mm-hmm.
And if we follow that line of thought in the Hebrew culture, then becoming servants to God was more in line with being able to be who we truly were than being slaves to Paro.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, like I said, everybody's a slave to their stomach on some level. You got to eat, right? But if you find a way to meet parnes, right, to make a living for yourself, a livelihood, not just a living, but a livelihood for yourself and your family, which is reflective of your values and vision for who you're meant to be in the world, so that's service. It's mm-hmm. not just slavery. So I want to spin scales for a minute, because another piece of the very important piece of the heroic project is that what's true for the individual is often true for the nation and even creation as well. On a national level, we are struggling to understand what it is to be the Jewish people today as a nation reborn in our land. And a theme that I've noticed in your work and your writing, as I see it from afar, is the theme of the struggle against empire,
mm-hmm.
Which of course is potentially also part of the Pesach story classically. But when, you know, when I've seen you making statements that it's time to free ourselves from the empire, can you tell me a little bit about what that means?
Well, practically.
Yeah, go practical first.
All right. On the front end, it means Israel becoming independent from the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that economically, militarily, diplomatically, that Israel is an independent country, also culturally,
mm-hmm.
that Israel should see itself as an independent actor on the world stage and not as an appendage to American power.
And just American power or to any power?
Well, I think that until now, or at least for the last few decades, certainly since the early 1970s, Israel has, well, I would say from the time of Ben-Gurion, there's been this superpower patronage doctrine.
It's a client-patron relationship.
Yeah, and that Israel's survival, remember, this is right after the Holocaust. Israel was a very vulnerable state, to say the least.
Mm.
And Ben-Gurion saw Israel's survival as being dependent on attaching ourselves to a big, powerful country.
Which he had inherited from the earlier Zionist movement, let's not forget.
I think the Jewish experience in Europe. I think the way Jews survived in many parts of Europe over the centuries.
Proximity to power.
Right. And to make ourselves valuable to the powerful Gentile, so he will protect us from
the other powerful Gentile.
Right. Or the less powerful Gentiles who just don't like us.
Who gang up and can make our lives difficult as well.
And this, I think, is part of how anti-Semitism as a system of oppression developed. I think that Jews in many parts of Europe, and I think this was later brought to North Africa, maybe by the French, certainly in Algeria and other places.
Like colonial regimes.
Yeah, that the Jews were given a certain level of privilege and proximity to power in order to help the regime oppress those who were less powerful. But the problem here is that when those at the bottom want to revolt against their conditions, the most accessible oppressor to lash out against is the Jew.
Jew becomes a cutout switch in right. the colonial system in that sense.
Right.
Right? The people reach to destroy. They get the Jew first because they're the middleman. And in doing that, the real power is able to step aside or retreat or reorient. We're seeing a lot of this today.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly it. I think Israel on a global stage has fallen into the trap of middle agent oppressor. We believe, I mean, in the time of Ben-Gurion, it was at first the Soviet Union, then it became France, but really since the early 1970s, it's been the United States. And if you ask, I mean, one of the reasons why I think it's in Israel's interest to keep Benjamin Netanyahu in office as long as possible is...
Well, it's a good thing that he agrees with you.
Right. Well, he's the only one I see who has a who's a potential prime minister who has a conception of Israel's interests other than being close to the United States. Meaning, I think that a person like Gantz or Gallant or Eisenkot, I think from their perspective, the most important thing for Israel is to be close to the United States, and all of the other issues might be issues for them, but they're secondary to that relationship. And I think that's a way of thinking that's really infected the higher ranks of our army, like the higher officers. And I think a lot of our journalists, a lot of, you know, the Israeli elites more broadly. And I think that Netanyahu, at the very least, has an ideological compass, at least from my perspective, where he has a conception of Israeli interests other than a relationship with the United States that might even be more important than a relationship with the United States.
I wouldn't hazard a discussion of Netanyahu's moral compass, but I am interested in the idea of liberating ourselves from empire on all those fronts. Meaning, I don't want to necessarily dive, although if you have what to say, I'm happy to hear it, into this sort of the geopolitical element. Mm-hmm. But what I'm really curious about, which I think is a very important element of the preparation for Pesach, is the cultural piece that you spoke about. That there's a Jewish Hebrew Israelite culture, which in my mind would include Torah with the capital T, not mm-hmm. just the definite article, but in its broadest sense. Mm-hmm. As well as many other things. And I'm curious what it would look like to actually become culturally independent.
Well, that's an important question, because what are we? You know, meaning, let's say, for example, we have a way for outsiders to become insiders, for a person who's not a Jew to go through an ancient ritual process that causes them to become a Jew.
Member of the tribe.
Right. And in the sense that even from a Kabbalistic perspective, if we're coming from the perspective that all Israel shares one giant soul,
all stood at Sinai in that sense,
then the non-Jew becoming a Jew receives a piece of that national soul.
Or reveals perhaps what had been lost in exile, but yes.
Maybe, right. But we're saying there's a way for an outsider to become an insider. No, yep. But he's joining something.
Yes.
He's joining something concrete. And even if we were to reach some crazy situation where 85% of Jews,
numerically speaking, yeah,
right, are gerim, are joining Israel, whereas only 15% of the Jews in the world are the actual biological descendants of Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, we would still all say we left Egypt. We would still all say those are our ancestors buried in Hebron.
Absolutely.
Meaning they're joining something. When a person becomes part of Israel, they're joining an identity, they're joining a story, they're joining a worldview. And that's what I think a lot of the Jewish world, including the Torah world, has lost.
What's the that in that sentence?
Well, the identity. What is this identity? For example, I've heard, you know, in certain, let's say, modern Orthodox spaces, mm-hmm. that it's one of the points of pride that we can adopt to almost any cultural environment, any civilization. But what is it that keeps us Jewish? Torah, halakha, etc. But there's not a concrete identity. Our values could be the identity. Our values could be the values of the West. Our values could be the values of Egypt. Our values could be the values of Greece or the United States. But as long as we have Shabbat once a week and a mikveh and a kosher restaurant and places of learning Torah, then we're us. And whereas I'm making the claim there's an us beyond all those things that requires a concrete understanding of what our identity is, what our story is, what our worldview is, what our value system is, and what our mission is in history.
So pause for a second, because this is a theme that I've really worked on a lot in my Jewish story class. And in particular, the phase I just ended in the live class, we went through from the Gaonic period all the way through the expulsion from Spain. Which is the Gaonic period in particular, I think, is a poorly examined, very important part of our history, because in many ways, specifically what you're saying, it was in the Gaonic period where Judaism really as an ism came to be. And by that I mean there was a one-to-one relationship between law and identity. Jew is what Jew does. And because of that, it's tremendously well adapted to survival in exile, like you're pointing out, that the law and Shabbat and the communal structures could be transported almost to any culture, eminently adaptable. And yet it's very important that for all the point of survival, what you're pointing out is that there also is something essential potentially lost there. And it's one of the real struggles we have today. I mean, I work with a lot of types of people in their personal life, in their Jewish life, in my counseling. And identity is a very painful thing. I'm thinking of someone in particular that I've worked with for quite some time who struggles with that tension of being a righteous convert and feeling very deeply attached to what it means to be a Jew, but lacking a visceral experience of it, right? Whether it comes to the Holocaust, right? Or whether it simply comes to the tribal element of that feeling of us, which is sort of almost ineffable and yet very real, and is, in my experience, what a lot of Jews find intoxicating about coming to the land of Israel and the state of Israel. Even if they're not religious per se, that sense of being part of the whole, as opposed to being a minority element,
being home in your own cultural environment.
Even though, as you're pointing out, we got a lot of work to do to make it so. I want to be more specific. First of all, Mikubala, I agree with you that there is, like, let's call it an essential fabric of identity, which we could say underlies or transcends, or maybe that language is important. But for right now,
well, this also brings us back to the question of freedom, because if we're self-identifying as, if I'm going to self-identify as a chelek Elokam Mimal, as a unique spark of the Creator in this world, that I'm a neshama, then I can say, well, how do I express that in this world? And And when we left Egypt, we went to Har Sinai and we received the Torah, and that Torah essentially told me and you how to be ourselves, how to fully express our souls, our true essence in this world. And I think that relationship to halakha, that relationship to Torah, that these are the finite details, these are the vehicles through which I express my true inner self in life from day to day, you know, year to year, etc., then that is freedom. That is freedom, living a life of Torah where I am subordinating myself. I mean, it came into the world in, like, law book form for a host of reasons we don't have to go into right now. It didn't necessarily have to. We learned that our ancestors, before we went to Egypt, were living Torah without the book. Right, like we learned,
and that God looked into the Torah and created the world. Meaning, there's a primordial Torah, if you will, that precedes the expression in law.
Right. And it's definitely not the Chumash, the five books of Moshe that Hashem was looking into to create the world.
Yeah,
right. It was something much bigger that expresses itself partially in this world through those five books.
Yes.
But the more I live according to the Torah, I'm expressing my true inner self. And if I know that, and if I experience that, then that's true freedom. In a way that maybe most humans don't have access to.
Well, I think that most of us don't have access to it because there isn't a systematic vessel, as you said, for actualizing the self. And because there's a lot of noise.
A lot of noise, but that noise is driven. Meaning, like, you ever watch Mad Men?
It's not white noise.
No. It's
different, specific voices attempting. I just want to finish. I was working with someone recently who was trying to find his own voice, so to speak, creatively. And I asked him how much time he spends listening to podcasts. And it was some enormous, I don't remember what it was. He rattled off like five or six podcasts that he listens to religiously. And I said, well, you know, so long as you always have somebody else's voice inside your ears when you're trying to think, how are you ever going to know what it is that you want to say? And I feel like that is the essence of our problem as a people. Like you said, it's not just that we looked in the United States for arms, which is, you know, reasonable, although I would like to see us quickly shift that. And it's not just that we also recognize that there are, I think, important values that we do share. Or there are others that we don't, but it's that we want their voice inside our head because it makes us feel good and accepted and like the popular kids on the planet. And,
right.
And that's not, it's just not.
But they're not the
thing.
Popular kids anymore.
No, that's the sad thing, right?
Right.
They're definitely not. But we've kidded ourselves into thinking, oh, the whole world. No. The Democratic Party is not the whole world, folks, nor are the Republicans.
Right. So that maybe brings us to another piece of what you're asking. The United States today is an empire in rapid decline. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
I don't think they know.
Well, you wouldn't know it from looking at mainstream media in the United States.
Well, that is always the problem, isn't it? Is that we tend to hold up a mirror to the world that we want to see, not the one that's actually there.
Right. And so for Israel, I mean, there are a lot of pieces to this. I think on the back end, look, Egypt is considered like the Av as opposed to Tolda.
The essential.
Okay.
The archetype.
Right. Of the enemy in history, let's say, right?
And well, there are different ones because Amalek is also an archetypical enemy, but yes.
In a different way.
They're one of the archetypes,
well,
for sure.
When I say enemy, I'm using the term enemy the way Yair would have used it.
Like a true opponent.
Well, he who's standing in the way of our mission.
Right, as opposed to the persecutor.
Right, right. So there are four derivatives of ancient Egypt. There's Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome, or Edom is probably a better term for the fourth empire. And so throughout history, there have been these empires that have tried to A, replace us, like actually be
literally
Israel,
be us, sure,
and B, stop us from being us.
Meaning, and in particular, to prevent us from coalescing as a people in our land.
Well, right, the Babylonians took us out of our land. The Persians, you know, under a Amalekite influence, tried to destroy us completely. The Greeks allowed us to be in our land, but tried to
destroy our identity.
Right, our culture, our identity, our Torah, and our worldview. And Edom, the fourth empire, which first emerged as Rome, but has morphed throughout history, and I think today is the United States, is...
I mean, they did have an orange president for a while, and they could again soon.
They might. They probably will, which I'm also nervous about, but that's... Maybe we can shelf that. But they have tried all three in more concentrated form.
Oh, yes.
They've tried to take our identity from us. They've tried to take our land from us. They've tried to kill us at times. And there have been different expressions of Edom along the way, of course. But I think that now we're living in an historic period where Israel has been coming back to life. You know, I was interviewed, I don't know if they aired it. It was on I-24.
Uh-huh.
And they told me the interview is going to be about why the West is so successful from the perspective of the Jews. And that, okay. So I came on and they asked me the question. And
you said, I don't think it's so successful.
No, I said, from a Jewish perspective, the West is really successful because Israel went into exile.
Yeah.
Because according to the prophecy of Rivka, she had two twins in her womb, and she was told that when one, you know, Esav...
One goes down, the other one goes out.
Right, Esav and Yaakov. So the West is successful because Israel went into exile.
Yeah.
And now that we're coming back, they're...
Bad news.
Right. They're weakening. They're falling. And I think just... It's built into the system. And I think that they didn't, I don't know if, it's possible they didn't air it. They certainly didn't message me saying it's up. I didn't get a Google
alert.
That's
just like a little over the head there.
Yeah, they were just like, what?
That's not what I was expecting from the geopolitical analysis.
No, they're probably expecting some like Tikva fund kind of answer as like, you know, the share.
Well, the conservative values of today are really a reflection of...
Exactly. I think that's what they were expecting. That's not what they got. And they tried to argue with me, but it wasn't as if these are new arguments. It's not like I've been saying this for a month and I haven't heard all the, you know,
well, as you pointed out, it's actually written in Sefer Bereishit.
Right. So that was it, you know, but I do think that right now, as Israel does become stronger, I do think the West is becoming weaker. I think it's connected. I think on a very intuitive level, Western civilization feels that. I think if we look at Mein Kampf, you know, Hitler, Yimach Shemo, I think, was an expression of Amalek. I would define Amalek as the most militant, self-aware component of Western civilization, of the civilization of Esav.
That's interesting. Okay, yeah. I hear it. I mean, he is the descendant of Esav.
Right. But I think that I think that also...
It was the militant, self-aware piece that I need to reflect on.
Yeah, right. I think that... If you look at all this like white nationalist stuff on social media or their own websites or whatever, there are a lot of conspiracy theories about the Jews. And the vast majority of them are nonsense. But what they're feeling is real, I think. Meaning, and what Hitler, Yimach Shemo, felt...
That somehow the Jews are taken over.
That the Jews are a threat to Western civilization. Yeah. And I think Amalek... as the most militant and self-aware component of Western civilization, sees itself as responsible to defend it. And, that, and that's what all the Nazis say they're doing, the white nationalists, all sure. these people, they're always defending Western civilization, right? They're accusing us of white genocide, of trying to replace them, change them, dilute them.
I would be remiss in not pointing out that it's not only the white nationalists right now mm-hmm. in the United States who are saying such things. Right, the whole horseshoe theory of the extremes of the political spectrum, meaning in the middle of Jew hate, has put the progressive world and allies within the more militant parts of American Muslim or Arab community right on the same map. Different, perhaps, perspective on the story, but ultimately the same end goal.
Yeah, we should have a separate conversation about horseshoe theory one day, because I don't buy into it, but I get why people do, and, uh-huh. and I think it's an interesting thing to
unpack. Okay, fair. I'm willing to table it.
But I think, yes, there are threats from the left and from the right and from the Islamic world,
but in the narrative structure you're painting, I understand that the West as an empire mm-hmm. is reflected in the sort of white Christian national ethos.
Well, right. I think the West more broadly, or Edom, Esav more broadly, has, you know, a spectrum of political and social views, but Amalek is that like tiny component that's always fighting to preserve it against its perceived threats. I think that the Jews are a perceived threat because on a very deep level, we are a threat, just because when we come back to life and when we become strong again, they will become weak again.
One goes up, the other goes down.
Right. So it could be that what they post about and tweet about or X about, whatever it's called now. And
it's the verb.
No, and what Hitler was writing about, the feeling was real. There's a threat, right? But the explanation that they come up with consciously is a ridiculous explanation. So, meaning, remember that the rise of the Nazis to power didn't take place before Zionism. It took place really...
Well after the real... Right. You know,
there was something happening that might have been causing him and other Nazis to feel like a potent threat from the Jewish people, but not being able to identify it. So,
let's not forget that, in fairness, that political anti-Semitism as a force and as a political commodity mm-hmm. within German society well predates the Nazis.
Right? Sure. You're
talking about a 19th century movement that mm-hmm. was like people
like Wagner. Funny.
No, but I'm talking about political anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. Like literally political parties that raise on their mm-hmm. banner were opposed to the word anti-Semitism mm-hmm. was coined in an essay which was about the struggle between the German spirit and the Jewish spirit, mm-hmm. which, by the way, says that the Jewish spirit had already won. Mm-hmm. In terms of what you're pointing out, right. is entirely correct. It's how I'm blanking on the man's name who wrote it right now. We can look it up later. But it's a fascinating essay in that he says basically we've already lost, we being the Germans. The Jews have already won. And as you're pointing out, that he sees the two as anathema, mm. that you cannot have them both.
Right. And this is a contradiction I think most Jews in the U.S. are not willing to really confront.
Well, because for all the panic it sets in the hearts of white nationalists, for the Jews, it goes back to our essential question, which is what I'd like to return to is, well, then who are we? Because mm-hmm. like you said, if I thought I was I grew up as a good American. Mm-hmm. I still consider myself American in many ways. It's just like, certainly culturally, you know, Yishai and I have that joke all the time that all the places we disagree is because he's Russian and I'm American.
I'm much more of a New Yorker than I'm an American.
Fair enough. New York is definitely a country unto itself. But I grew up in Ohio, for goodness sake. Right. You know?
That's America.
Nobody says they're Clevelander. I mean, you do, but with a little bit of shame. No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. So let's take a last few minutes here because I know that time is precious. And maybe offer a little bit of an activist approach, because I know that activism is a very important part of your life. We were speaking before about how like the term peace activist doesn't really fit the bill for the engagement that you seek with the complex situations that we find ourselves in here. But you're an activist, and it's one of the things I really both love and respect about you and I would like to learn from. So let's think about activists for cultural liberation. What does it look like? Here we are. We're approaching Pesach. I think we agree that an essential definition of freedom is what it is to be ourselves. We've already offered a very important sort of guide to that in the sense that Torah is a vessel for giving actualizations that essential divine peace within each Jew. So therefore there's a freedom, not in the sense of liberation from, but a freedom of being you that happens through Torah. But how else? How is people, in particular people who don't necessarily find Torah the easiest access, mm-hmm. what would you call people to in terms of that sense of cultural freedom, liberation?
Well, I think for those who do engage with the Torah, there's a way to engage with the Torah that is much more freedom oriented or clarifying our identity and our mission in history oriented.
What's that look like?
Well, I think we have that more in Israel. And I would even argue more in like the French language Torah that exists than in the English language Torah. I think the English language Torah that exists is very noticeably, at least for me, it's very noticeably missing that national, historical, mission-oriented component in all its flavors. So we're talking about Haredi Torah, modern Orthodox Torah. Even Chabad has its own mission, which is another conversation.
Talk about a country unto itself. Yeah,
right. But it's not like necessarily the historic mission of Am Yisrael,
except in the most broad Hasidic sense.
Okay, but no, I mean they have an important mission that's relevant.
Chabad is an entity unto itself. It's also a big institution. But yeah,
but there's this. So I think that when we teach Torah, it's important to contextualize it within this historic mission, and that's what I really appreciate about the whole world of Rav Kook, the Rav Kook institutions that are the students of Rav Tzvi Yehuda that really focus on this more like mission-oriented Torah. I think it's very important.
And historical, meaning it's real here and now. It's not some abstract
Right,
process.
And to be able to think of our story as being unpaused. Like there's a Jewish story that to a certain extent was unpaused. Not that things didn't happen, not that there weren't important developments in thought, etc., but the real story
the
of Israel.
The national momentum had stalled for quite some time.
Right. So that's within the Torah world, within a Torah context, how we approach Torah is important. But I think there's so many areas where we should just be asking these questions. Obviously, you know, I've spoken many times, I think even on your show, about decolonizing Jewish identity, applying post-colonial tools to the Jewish experience in a very real way. We do a lot of that in the Vision Movement. If anybody
gives one example of what that might look like.
Well, what does it mean for a state to be Jewish? I mean, that's a great example. What does it mean for a healthcare system to be Jewish? What does it mean for an economy to be Jewish? What does it mean for an army to function in a Jewish way? I mean, these aren't really questions we've had to struggle with in a long, long time, and they're relevant for us now. Also, just healing from our own trauma. I think part of decolonization is healing. Big. And we haven't done that. We've basically kicked the can down the road and down the road and down the road rather than confront what happened to us. How do we heal from it? What kind of society do we want to create? What are its values? What's its identity? How do you express that in policies and institutions?
Wait, I just want to ask you to pause on healing for 1 minute because it's a subject so important and so close to my heart. And because in my eyes, the healer, the Rofe, is one of the crucial central models of heroism in Torah. So I want to give a word of advice to everybody listening. Also to you, maybe if you haven't thought about it, but I'm willing to bet you have. Which is, we're in a time of a lot of anger. We're war.
Yeah.
And like, I have teenage kids, you've got teenage kids. I don't know if your kids express a lot of anger around the table, but I hear a lot of it. And
directed towards the Palestinians.
Toward Arabs in general.
No.
You know, that's generally the focus, yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I try to teach my kids, which is one of the essential skills of healing, which is that anger is really a secondary emotion. Most often that emerges from pain, fear, and sadness. And anger rarely lends itself to healing. Now, sometimes it's an important response to situations, not necessarily, you know, there's a whole bit of debate, I'm sure you're familiar with in Torah, whether anger has any place at all in the spectrum of you know, sort of tikkun amidot, and of fixing one's elements of character. But my point is that the way to heal is to avoid the alchemy of transforming our fear, pain, and sadness into anger, and to learn how to hold fear, pain, and sadness, to learn how to hold them. That healing from our trauma, and this is where I'm saying it, you're entirely correct, we've kicked the can down the road in building a very militant stance on so many things, which is not all bad. I'm not down on military, trust me, I'm incredibly grateful and proud, and it's a mitzvah, but there's more to the story than the ability to crush our enemies
in
anger.
Look, power is important. We have power. I really like what you're saying, because we have power for the first time in 2,000 years, but we can't, we have to diversify. Meaning
we don't know how to wield it until we heal.
Right. But what the power, even in the form that we have it now, allows us to do is to safely explore the sadness and the pain and the fear in ways we weren't able to safely explore it before when we were powerless.
That is the goal. 100%.
Yeah.
So I think there's a certain liberation in that.
Right. And I think that's something we desperately need as a people to do, to undergo.
But it begins as individuals.
Yeah. And I think that part of that journey is identifying who are we, because and who do we want to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I think these are the conversations that need to be taking place in the Jewish world right now. What, as
around
individuals,
the table.
Around that, for sure, because it's part of our liberation. That's freedom from, because as much as the freedom of is important,
it's
and
the
crucial,
vision that we're headed toward. Yeah.
The freedom from, the liberation from, is also crucial because we do have oppressors even today. And I don't mean Iran, and I don't mean the Palestinians or Hamas or Hezbollah. I think these are like parties we have to fight, but ultimately
they're enemies. They're not oppressors anymore.
But ultimately I would say it's our relationship with the U.S. that needs to be called into question on a very deep level. And we have to understand. And I suspect right now there's so much. I know you don't want to get geopolitical, but
I didn't say I don't want to. I said, I'm not, that's not really my cup of tea. I said, you can speak about what moves you.
My sense of what's going on is that the real issue is not the war. The real issue is what happens after the war.
Mm.
I think the Americans very much want a Palestinian state here.
Sure.
They want to divide our land. They want to thwart the Gula process, as the Empire of Edom should.
Like, whether they're aware of it or not. I mean, right. They would probably tell you what they want is justice. And you know,
yeah, no, I think on a deep, deep collective subconscious level, there's a feeling of being threatened by the rebirth of Israel. I think in general,
the Jews can't win.
Well, I think since the time of Ben-Gurion, I think the machloket between Israel and the United States over the state of Israel has been whether or not we want to see it as like a bomb shelter for persecuted Jews that
right.
the West will support and fund and arm, versus the characters of Tanakh come back to life in the modern age.
Right, a thriving platform for people in power to actually finally fulfill our mission in history.
Right. And I think that...
Yeah, they're not interested in the second
one. No, the Americans are happy to support, fund, arm a state of Israel that is an extension of their power and a uniquely Jewish or a bomb shelter for persecuted Jews.
Oh, yeah, ghetto in the Middle East.
Right, that they're in control of. That
yes.
they completely control and can rely on that control.
Yes.
They don't have to worry about some rogue prime minister or some population that they didn't see before. Like,
going off the farm.
Exploding into this huge, you know, sector of Israeli society that now has all this control that they didn't have yesterday. Ehud Barak tweeted about a year or so ago that the biggest fear of the Western leaders is that Israel's nuclear arsenal is going to fall into the hands of like the national
the
religious
Ben-Gur.
And Haredim. And
right.
right. Like meaning that's, I get it. I do get the fear from their perspective. It's something worth discussing, but I think that's always been the machloket, whether or not this is a historically significant event, like historically significant is actually an understatement, versus whether it's just like a bomb shelter for persecuted Jews that the West is supporting.
Is it a shift in the divine story?
And I think right now, what's most important to the United States, I don't think they care how many Palestinians Israel kills. I don't think it's important to
Sadly,
them.
I don't think it matters to them.
In fact, they just gave Gallant a whole lot of weapons.
Yeah, all the talk is, you know, been there, keep giving those precision bombs.
But what they want is to remove Netanyahu from office. I mean, it's very clearly part of the American agenda.
Could it be more obvious?
Right. And I think that when I see that, what...
The irony is it makes people like me actually want him to stay.
Yeah. No, but I actually think from the American perspective, Netanyahu is the barrier to them being able to achieve their agenda here.
Yeah.
Then of course we want him to stay.
Yeah.
And I don't see anybody else who could fulfill that role. And I think I've been suspecting this since Bennett became prime minister. Since I saw Netanyahu's speech when power was handed over to Bennett, he said something. I don't even remember what it was, but when I remember my feeling watching this speech, it suddenly clicked in my head. From Netanyahu's perspective, I think he's been protecting us from the Americans all this time. He can't say it out loud because you just don't do that.
Right.
But I think that he understands that the real danger, the real threat is coming from Washington, not from Tehran. And he's been playing this game very quietly. And because it's the kind of thing you can't say out loud, I mean, now he is, because they've pushed him to the point where he has to.
Yeah.
But because for so long he couldn't say it out loud, the country, including his own supporters, didn't know what he was doing.
Mm.
And I think that a lot of the ambiguity surrounding who Netanyahu is, what's important to him, like what drives him, really comes from the fact, maybe, and I think we'll find out maybe 50, 100 years from now, when we learn this period of Israeli history, we might learn about, or our grandchildren might learn, great-grandchildren might learn about Netanyahu as this tragic figure who is trying to protect the nation of Israel from a threat he couldn't say out loud.
Mm. So, I mean, this is very powerful, even though I wasn't interested in geopolitics. I think you very nicely summed. No, come on now. This is a two-way street. That was actually a segue into me saying that this is an excellent way, I think, to wrap things up, because what you're pointing out is that there is a continuum from the individual struggle to be who I am, through a national struggle to be who we are as people, to a scale of creation attempting to express the truth of divine will, and that the obligation to liberate ourselves from is bound up with the desire to be free to be, and that really this is the task to which we're set in the month of Nisan, that the Hebrew national Rosh Hashanah, New Year is the word I believe, the Hebrew national year, in that sense that we as a people came into being for the purpose of being who we are, and that our struggle to do so takes place on many fronts, and that I just want to wish to you and to myself and to all the people out there who are listening, and my family and my friends and Klal Yisrael and to the world, that we take the time and do the effort to learn who we are in order to serve the role we're meant to serve in the world, and that we should merit, just like we were redeemed in Nisan in days gone by, so too should we merit to be redeemed in Nisan speedily in our day.
I'm in.
All right, Yehuda HaKohen, if people are interested in the type of thought you're expressing, where would they go to learn more about it?
Well, the best place to go is Vision Magazine. It's visionmag.org. You could also follow me on Instagram, Yehuda HaKohen, or Facebook. I have a Twitter account or an X account or whatever it's called now, but I don't think I know how to use it properly. It could be my age.
Anybody wants to help out with that, you can also keep me in touch. Volunteers
Absolutely.
Are always welcome.
Absolutely. Volunteers are always welcome. Or you could check out our website at visionmovement.org. We have plenty of programs there, educational programs, online programs, if people are interested in learning with us. But I really encourage everyone to check out the magazine and, of course, our podcasts.
And I just want to say that if people are looking for a way in which they can change their perspective, which, of course, is in many ways the first step towards freedom, I don't think you could find a better place to go to challenge your thought than the Vision Movement. And I so much appreciate you taking the time and sharing your whole self. And if folks want to check out more about the Heroism Project, that's, you know, jewishheroism.com. Also on Instagram now, the Jewish Heroism Project. Super excited about what's happening out there. You can be in touch with me, robmikeboyer@gmail.com. And if you'd like to put your money where your ears are, you can always go to the website, jewishheroism.com. There's a button in the upper right-hand corner there that says donate. We're open now to one-time U.S. tax-free. Use the empire to your advantage, people, and support our quest for freedom. I want to thank everybody out there who does that. I want to thank all the folks who make the show happen. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Rav Mike Foyer, and this is the Jewish Heroism Project.